wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning to all our listeners in the greater Portland area and beyond. You are tuned to KBOO Portland, your community radio, still on the air in the time of the coronavirus. It's time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I am Patricia Kohlberg, your host for the show. Today is Indigenous Peoples Day. Later on in the show, we will be hosting a discussion of some of the most pressing issues that Indigenous communities currently face, and our music today will highlight Indigenous artists. We are now in the middle of our fall membership drive. If you have the resources, please consider a donation to KBOO. Now, more than ever, we rely on independent media like KBOO to bring us the news and analysis that we cannot get through mainstream media. KBOO is one of the very few places in Portland where you can find a socialist, feminist, anti-racist, and anti-colonialist perspective on the multiple crises we face today, including climate catastrophe, the rise of violent white supremacy, the anti-racist uprisings, the pandemic, and economic collapse. We aren't in the station to take your calls, but you can show your support by giving online at kboo.fm/give, or you can also mail a contribution to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. Where else are you going to hear about an archival project to preserve the history of fossil fuel resistance in the Pacific Northwest? Or how dystopian literature can see into the future and help us prepare for it? Or why a Black socialist should vote for Joe Biden? These are just a few of the issues that we cover here on the Old Mole. So if you like what you hear, please consider a donation today. And thank you to all of our generous supporters out there. Today on our show, Robin White speaks with Julian Ankeny about pressing issues in Indian country, and Jan Hawken interviews Hyung Nam about police accountability efforts in Portland. To begin our show, Bill Resnick interviews economist Yeva Nersisian about the deepening economic crisis in this richest of countries, the struggles between Trump and the Congress on a still possible worker relief and economic stimulus package, and what a good package would provide.
Hello, Yeva Nersisian. Welcome to KBOO again.
Hi, Bill. Thanks for having me back on the show.
Yeva Nersisian teaches economics at Franklin and Marshall, a smallish quality liberal arts school 80 miles west of Philadelphia and Amish country in Pennsylvania, which is, of course, one of the most important of the swing states. Yeva Nersisian, for most of this year, has been studying and writing on the federal multi-trillion dollar relief program as the pandemic shut down the economy. She and many others have found that the federal government is continuing a long-term trend that big business, the banks, fossil fuel industry, the private sector, and their executives, and main beneficiaries, of course, they have done really well in the pandemic in getting federal money and in making big profits. As to small business, though, and the great majority of the people, help has been erratic and small, and precariousness and fear have increased. We'll be talking today about how the U.S. Congress is deadlocked on the provisions of a relief bill for the many millions of people laid off and facing eviction or mortgage foreclosure due to the COVID virus pandemic. We'll be discussing that deadlock, and will, at the last minute, before the election, will the Republicans pass a maybe trillion-dollar deal? It's not very much, actually, but still we give big chunks of money, one-time money, to near every adult or somehow distributed around the country, which would, of course, have the effect of increasing the chances of victory for Trump and the Republicans. I've been expecting that for a long time, so I understand, as does Yeva, and we're very surprised it hasn't happened yet. also will be discussing what must be done and should be done to save lots of people, their homes, their lives, also to maintain economic functioning in this country, and also to reconstruct our economy. Yevhen Nersisyan, tell us about the pain, suffering, worry, the deep anxiety for so many people. What's happening to the lower half?
Well, with the federal aid running out and the moratorium on foreclosures and evictions ending, I believe, in August, the situation is likely to get worse without additional federal stimulus spending. By some estimates, the state and local governments have already laid off 1.5 million workers, mostly in education, and that is going to continue most likely because of the situation that state and local governments find themselves in. The small business aid is running out. That means that a lot of the small businesses will probably go under. We don't have a good way of tracking that. We see the big corporations, when they file for bankruptcy, we don't really have a good way of knowing how many small businesses are closing, but they are closing permanently, many of them. So these jobs are not going to come back even after the pandemic is over. Those particular jobs are not to come back for sure. And, of course, the one-time stimulus payment, which was very small, that maybe put a small dent in people's expenses, but couldn't go a long way. What was even more important was the extra $600 of unemployment benefits that people were getting. And that has disappeared. Some states are doing the extra $300, which Trump signed an executive order for. So some states are doing that, but not all the states. And given that our unemployment benefits are generally very stingy, they cover about, on average, 45% of a person's compensation before they lost their job. And in some states, it can, of course, be lower than the 45% because the 45% is an average. So that means the situation is going to get pretty bad for working-class Americans. And foreclosure filings would probably go up. Foreclosures would probably increase. Evictions would probably increase as well, just as we're getting close to winter and cold weather in many parts. So people could become homeless. So it's a bad situation overall, I would say.
And especially, I think, the both restaurant and entertainment industry and a lot of those service jobs are going away. That's likely to happen even if they do pass a big bill. I think because so many elderly people are just not going to go out into the economy until, in fact, they're really safe. And the poorest and the least secure are going to be hit very hard. And that means the cities are going to have to respond. So first bill, the money's run out, things are quite grim for a lot of people. The Democrats in the House have passed a $2 to $3 trillion bill, which also had money for the hard-pressed cities and states. The Republicans were talking about a much more modest bill without aids to the cities and states. What are the possibilities? And is there going to be an October surprise that I've been expecting that Trump will flood the country with money and get people checks so he'll win the election?
I thought it was going to happen much sooner, frankly, because of those same reasons you mentioned. The Democrats did pass a pretty big spending bill. I think it was in May. The House passed it, and then the Senate said no. And then they offered their own, which was much, much smaller, maybe 10 times smaller than what the Democrats had offered. But now the Democrats just a few days ago passed another, I believe, $2.2 trillion bill or 2.6, which includes another round of stimulus payments. It includes the extra $600 of unemployment benefits. It also includes about $460 billion of aid to state and local governments. And that is very important. So I would say the one-time stimulus payments, they are helpful for people, but they're not as important as, say, the extra unemployment benefits, because the extra unemployment benefits are more targeted. They're targeted people who have actually lost their jobs. If I get the stimulus check, I still have my job. Nothing has changed. So I'm really not going to spend much of it. So it's really not going to flow back into the economy. And I think there are some estimates that only 4 out of every $10 of the stimulus money has been spent. While the unemployment benefits, they're going to people who have lost their jobs, and they're likely to use that income to pay for rent and for other necessities. So I would say the extra unemployment benefits are very important. The Senate's version wanted to cut it to extra $300 rather than $600. And the Senate's bill did not include aid to state and local governments, which I would say is the other very important thing we need to do, because state and local governments really rely on tax revenue. Their tax revenues have taken a hit because they rely on sales taxes, on property taxes. Many of them had extended the property tax payment deadlines, and who knows if they're actually going to get paid. Of course, sales tax revenue has decreased, and state and local governments actually are a very big part of our economy because they rely on tax revenues. When their tax revenues decrease, they also have to cut their spending because they have balanced budget amendments in their constitutions. Many of them do. And so that means cutting spending on social services. So when we need them to step up because more people will need assistance, that's when they are actually going to start cutting services because they're running out of money. And that's going to be a big problem. It is usually a problem in recessions. As the federal government is injecting spending, state and local governments are doing the opposite. So they're sort of working against the recovery. I'm not blaming them. That's just how they are set up to operate. And in this case, it's going to be much worse than in any other recession we've seen because of how big the shortfall in their revenues is and how quickly that happened over a few months. And without federal aid, it's going to get bad.
I wonder what the Republicans are thinking. I can understand why they don't want to give state governments money. They want to starve the beast. They want to destroy any semblance of a welfare state or a regulatory state on the amount that the big predators and the smaller predators can sort of squeeze out of people. Without states trying to regulate their predation, they could probably make a lot of money in the short run. It seems to me it's madness.
Yeah. You know, Treasury Secretary has apparently offered his own version of a stimulus, which is about $1.6 trillion. I'm not sure if it includes aid to state and local governments, but there are negotiations happening. So 2 weeks ago, there didn't seem to be any movement on the issue. But right now, it seems like the administration is negotiating with House Democrats. And if they come to an agreement, it's possible that the Senate will approve it, or at least some version of it. But for political purposes, it seems like they're a little late because it's going to take time for that money to go to people. If they do another round of stimulus checks, it's not going to be immediate. Or if they do increase the extra $600, people might not see that immediately. So I'm really not sure why they haven't passed anything yet.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Note the variety is in the variety of struggles coming from below in this increasingly tumultuous period. I'm talking to Yevhen Narcissian, a progressive economist, been studying the government economic response to the COVID epidemic. As to the businesses, there are big ones, and the people in power, they're doing really well at the federal trough nowadays. We've been talking about the suffering, though, by millions of people across the country, their precarious lives. And what could happen if, in fact, they don't receive a huge infusion of money, the homelessness and hungry children that will be the product of the Republican intransigence? I don't think they care about that much. They would rather destroy the cities and states, that is, the helping programs, is my sense. But we will see. It would help Trump a great deal, and I'm sure Republicans in Senate will go along. You have a Narcissian. No matter who's in power, who wins the election, the economy is going to be in deep trouble and they're going to have to try and somehow stimulate it in one way or another. The Republicans will just sort of give tax breaks to the rich. I'm not sure how much good that does anymore. They can't even count their monies in the trillions. They just stick it into various kinds of bond funds around the world and stocks and the rest. Real estate now, they'll buy up all that distressed real estate. My great hope is that under a Biden administration, something could be done. Give us an outline of what's necessary that could be done by the Biden administration.
Yeah, I think you're right that the economy isn't going to suddenly recover if Joe Biden becomes president, partly because we haven't solved the health issue. We still have a pandemic. You know, if it was a regular recession, I would say, well, there is no recession bad enough that a stimulus couldn't help. But in this case, it is difficult to do that because of the social distancing needs, because of all the health precautions that we need to take. So in the short term, I would say it's important to remember what the economy is for or should be for. It's for provisioning people with the things that they need. So you can do that either by giving them money through stimulus checks and other kinds of payments. You could do that by directly providing aid, whatever people need, and putting a moratorium on debt payments and evictions. And in a sense, that way you're controlling their expenses, and a moratorium could be more open-ended, that it's going to continue for as long as we need, rather than a stimulus payment or program that's going to run out on, I don't know, August 1st, right? So you could do something like that where you're controlling people's expenses, making sure they're staying afloat while the pandemic is still raging. After we have solved the problem, the healthcare problem, we definitely need to do something like a Green New Deal. This pandemic demonstrated at so many levels that we absolutely need another New Deal. Just like the original New Deal, which was pretty green, this one needs to be green. As we need a job guarantee to guarantee people a decent paying job and therefore income. So we need to do that from sort of at the bottom up rather than letting the chips fall where they may and then try to use redistribution policies to try to level the playing field. We do need to green our economy. In terms of climate change, it looks like we don't have a lot of time left. And climate scientists say that another Trump presidency would basically be game over for the climate. And Biden has pledged to spend about $2 trillion on greening the economy. That will not just green the economy, it will also create jobs and decent jobs to transition people out of fossil fuel industries and so on, because that's something that we absolutely need as well. And of course, the Medicare for All at this point should be a no-brainer. The Democrats are still clinging to the Affordable Care Act, which I can see that it's, you know, better than nothing, but it doesn't seem like that's going to survive for too long. So a Medicare for All would be a much, much better option, of course. So, yeah, that would be my sort of wish list. Yeah.
Well, I'm gonna rec you in for the Senate seat in Pennsylvania.
Okay.
I hope other people did too, and you could get 10 votes maybe. Yes. Yelena Sisyan, thanks a lot for talking to us again. Keep up your good work.
Yeah, thank you. It's been good talking to you.
That was Bill Resnick speaking with economist Yeva Nersisyan about our deepening economic crisis. On Indigenous Peoples Day, we are reminded that racial capitalism is also an internal colonial project, and it is Indigenous communities that have suffered the brunt of colonization within the U.S. To highlight the ways in which they've been affected, Lakota Cheyenne organizer and Old Mole member Robin White speaks with Nimiipuu writer and educator Julian Ankeny. They discuss the most pressing issues in Indian country, including murdered and missing Indigenous women and men, and access to education and health care.
I'm here with Julian Ankeny. Julian is a tribal member of the Nimiipuu tribe. She teaches creative writing and Native American literature and co-teaches Nimiipuu Temt, language, reclamation, revitalization, and learning at Washington State University. We're recognizing Indigenous Peoples Day today. There's a lot of issues in the Native community in the country today, and particularly in Washington and Oregon. And you know, there's no way that we can hit them all, and there's no way we can go into depth in them all, but we'd sure like you to know what some of the issues are that trouble us and are working on us, and hope that you join us to try and really help address some of these situations. And some of those are murdered and missing Indigenous women and murdered and missing Indigenous men, education. We've always had an issue with it, but we're really having deepening issues in that. We might want to talk about since time immemorial, which is mandated history taught in the school systems in Oregon and Washington, which is a big first. And Title VI Indian education, which is not being taught in the school system, even though in many school systems in the area, even though it's federally mandated. Healthcare in Indian country is absolutely abysmal, and we think we need to talk a little bit about that. And environmental justice and climate collapse, and what that means to everybody, not just tribal entities, but certainly to the fish and to the water and to the orcas and everything around us. Julian, would you like to break in here and address any of this? I know you've had some experience, as we all have, with different parts of this, and we'd sure like to know what your thoughts are.
Yes. Thank you, Robin. Inamunik Dwas, Julian Ankeny. My name is Julian Ankeny, and I am a Nimipu, Nez Perce, as the French fur trappers named us long ago. Nez Perce is basically a translation of the vernacular back in the day, nose pierce. So Nez Perce, that's the name that stuck, but we actually refer to ourselves as Nimipu, the people. Missing and murdered Indigenous women and men lies very, very close to my heart. It's not only an epidemic, but it's almost an invisible epidemic up until recently. All, you know, tribal nations know that this is a problem, and we've been speaking up about it for a long time. We just have, a lot of people have felt like they have never been heard until now. So it gives us hope. So it's just not a story of, you know, of loss, but also of hope. So with that, these are also stories that need to be told, right? Because a lot of missing and murdered Indigenous women and men don't get national attention or even public attention. A lot of the times, a lot of these stories just get swept under the rug. So we need to put life back into these stories. And we have a Nimiput Timt, Nez Perce language word that means life, and it's Wakiswit. So Wakiswit, life. So we need to give life to these stories. Just to give you a few statistics on missing and murdered Indigenous men and women. It's just not, you know, women that go missing. There's so many men that too, they also go missing. From 2019, there was 5,500 reported missing Indigenous women in the U.S. And those are the only reported numbers. There are so many unreported cases all over the U.S., as well as cases of men who also go missing. The summer of 2018, my brother, Michael Murphy, he just vanished. He went missing, and we have not been able to find him yet. And I have had to work with two different law agencies within the Valley because of jurisdiction issues and different things. At first, they wouldn't even believe that he was missing. They're like, well, you know, is he just running from cops or something? And we're like, okay, dude, he's missing. So, you know, at first we weren't even taken seriously. And a lot of these cases and a lot of these missing people aren't taken seriously. 4 out of 5 Native women experience violence towards them. Native women experience violence 10 times higher than the national average. And 90% of that violence is actually from non-Native partners. So it's a really big epidemic.
Yeah, I really appreciate it. I'm sorry about your brother. It seems that everybody in Indian country has been touched by this with a relative or a friend. And it's something that really needs to be dealt with. And another thing I think is we're still having children stolen from us through adoption and through the legal system. And even though this is supposed to be federally mandated to not be legal, you know, it's still happening, and we need to address that as well. We were talking a little about education too, and about how really bad it is in Indian country to try and get an education, whether that's at kindergarten through 12th grade or higher education, and what that means. I touched a little bit on that since time immemorial, which the Native Caucus of Washington in particular was particularly helpful in getting passed, and in Oregon, Washington, it's both passed, and Washington State University has helping in those areas. The local tribes get to decide what that is in their areas, that curriculum, and trying to get that into the schools and get that to where teachers can grasp it and be comfortable with it is an effort that we're trying to do. I think it's an important thing, but I think it's also important to know that, you know, that's a few minutes of every quarter or every semester that these kids are getting it. It's a start, but it's just a start. So, you know, ask your kids what they're learning in school and try and go to your school boards and to your teachers and find out what that is. And let's, since we got that foot in that door, let's try and open that door and try and make it a real history project that people know what their neighbors and what the first people here in this country, their history. What's your experience, Julian, with your education? And just to kind of hit a few short highlights of some troubles that you might have had and or are having, either as a teacher or as a student.
Yes. So I actually didn't go to a tribal school on a reservation, although my children that I have now do, three of which are adopted. So I actually have four children. That issue of, you know, adoption and the Indian Child Welfare Act also hits very close to home because there are more, you know, Indian children that actually need foster care than there are readily available Native families that can actually take them in due to a variety of different circumstances. That issue combined with a lower, compared to the national education rate, it's much lower in Indian country due to so many biopsychosocial events that impact schooling. So for me, living off the reservation, I actually experienced lots of systematic racism as a child in high school. I actually experienced the most systemic racism was when I got into higher education and was juxtaposed to all these other people's beliefs about, you know, how Indians should behave was a vast contrast to how I am and how I hold myself. So it's
right, because all Indians are the same, of course. You know?
Right. I had one lady talk to me once and couldn't figure out what I was. And she's like, "Well, I know you're not Mexican because your English is impeccable."
Oh,
and I was like, "Oh my goodness. I can't believe she said this to me, you know." And I was like, "I'm actually Native American." She's like, "Oh, well, I could tell you had brown skin." I'm like, "Oh Lord."
Oh, yeah.
And not only that, a lot of European Americans don't know all the genocide. They don't know about the Trail of Tears or all of these stories like the U.S. cavalry coming in and cutting out the vaginas of women and girls and stretching them over their saddle horns as souvenirs. And just all of these like atrocities leading up to boarding schools, which is a whole nother issue. And there's so much grief and historical trauma in those different stories. It's history. But this is history that we're actually hearing from our grandparents and our great aunties.
Right. I'm Cheyenne and Lakota. I'm enrolled at Pine Ridge. And when we're talking about these things in this historical aspect, people keep saying, "Well, it was so long ago, it doesn't matter anymore." Well, I heard these stories from my grandmother and great-grandmother, and great-grandmother was there. That puts it into perspective. You know, if you can touch someone and you talk to someone, that's recent enough history for me to have issues with it and to keep that. And, you know, there's always remember the Alamo or this and that, but apparently Indian issues die 30 minutes after the atrocity was done. Appreciate what you're talking about there. We have some other issues that are up right at the moment too, which are the land grant universities that took thousands and thousands and thousands of acres from natives and maybe in your state or out of a state. And they used that land for these universities that natives certainly, particularly at first, weren't allowed to enter into or become educated from. And when they were educated, largely it was to become farmhands and to laundresses and the more menial and labor type jobs instead of lawyers and doctors and so on. So we call it the land grab universities, trying to address that as well. And, you know, we hope that people kind of start considering where their education came from and how that was financed was largely on the backs of these Native American and what that means and what it means in the future. There are cultural differences when you're in these school systems that we need to be dealing with and need to talk about. And we need to talk about some how to make parity in this, in education, and how important that is to try and fill the jobs in our tribal entities and just in general to get to raise up the quality of education for our people. Title VI Indian education, as I said, in Clark County hasn't even been done for 4 years or so because the school system just ignores it, even though it's not an unfunded mandate, but they just don't want to deal with it. So, you know, we need to work on some of that. Julian, you've had some experience in the just atrocious state of healthcare for Native Americans. Can you give me a little bit of an idea of what your situation has been?
Yes. So I do have like personal anecdotal stories. And then I also know like so many people who have experienced just like the utmost atrocities from the healthcare industry. My first pregnancy, I was pregnant with twins, and I didn't even know that I was supposed to get prenatal care. I was actually living in Seattle at this time. I never received any prenatal care. And then my water broke, and I didn't know my water broke because I didn't have any prenatal care. I was really young. I was 19 years old. So I went to the emergency room, and they sent me home. They didn't do a pelvic exam or anything. And then later that night, it was about 11 o'clock, and I went to the bathroom and I felt something. And I was like, well, that felt weird. And so I, you know, reached my fingers up my vagina a little bit, and I felt little toes. And then I reached up a little farther, and I felt a little tiny foot about the size of my thumb. And that's when I knew, you know, I needed to call the ambulance. Wow. And I, you know, I was rushed to the hospital in an ambulance, and it was very, very traumatic. And I remember telling myself, like, I'm never going to have this happen to me again. I need to know what these doctors are saying. So it actually made me get my certification as a certified nursing assistant. And then I got pregnant with my daughter, who actually passed away when she was 18 months old from SIDS. But with her, I was actually life-flighted from Lewiston to Spokane because, like my first pregnancy, my water broke a little too soon. So I was flown up there. And so that again was a very traumatic experience. And then my third pregnancy, actually, I had a botched cesarean section. Because I had all this medical knowledge now that, you know, I was what they do when you have a C-section, they secure your arms. So you kind of feel like Jesus, right? So your arms are secured. You can only see the roof or the ceiling of the operating room. And the doctor took so long extracting or putting me together, whatever he was doing, that I could actually feel my body going into shock. And the epidural started wearing off, and I could actually feel the doctor, you know, pushing my organs back into my stomach. So yeah, very, very traumatic things that happen. My kids' mom, actually, she over in the Toppenish Valley of Washington, actually got into a car wreck, a pretty, you know, a violent car wreck where she broke her collarbone and she had massive head trauma where she was in and out of consciousness. And one hospital over there just sent her home. And then the second hospital that she went to, because she was still blacking out and stuff the next day, and she had blood all caked in her hair, they actually said, well, if you were at this other hospital, where's your record? This hospital says they have no record of you being there. And she's like, well, that's impossible. I was just there, you know, a few days ago. And they said that the hospital said they didn't have her record. The only thing that made them believe her was she actually had her discharge paperwork still in her purse. So
the death rates on Indian reservations are incredible. I think the life expectancy is on my reservation, I think, is around 50 something for both men and women. We just got a dental clinic in Portland just a couple of years ago. That's what, the seventh or eighth largest Native community in the country. People are dying right and left, particularly on the reservations. And even in the Indian health clinics here, there's no equipment in there. Everything, we have to go out for everything. And if you have no insurance, you're at the mercy of doctors that are willing to serve you for free for anything that's other than kind of Band-Aids. And you go in and they'll tell you, yeah, you're sick, and kind of what you're sick of, more or less. And then, sometimes you're on your own. So these are situations that we have to deal with. I hear you're having a gig going on in Berkeley, California. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so October 29th, but you have to register before the event to attend the event. Four to five Pacific time, October 29th. The full description of the event, this event is presented alongside the Hearst Museum's current online exhibit, Cloth That Stretches, Weaving Community Across Time and Space, which explores textiles as a site of identity, formation, and cultural resilience. At a time when people are divided by many challenges facing our communities today, a pandemic, racial injustice, climate change, this program offers a rare chance to build community through the tangible objects in the Hearst Museum's collection, and sometimes intangible, the language and story, and inspire audiences to help the world around them through creative and introspectional approaches. We are going to be in conversation with Professor Beth Piatote, and we are going to read some poetry about weaving.
You know, the last thing I think we need to touch on, we've only got a minute, so I'm just going to say, the climate is collapsing. We need to take care of the water. We need to take care of the air. They're the same thing. We need to do right by all the other living things around us in the world. It's our duty to treat water with respect. It's our duty to treat the world with respect and each other with respect. And we're going to die if we don't do that. The world is going to die as we know it. And it's disrespectful. It's something that we have to change. And I want to thank you, Julian, for all of your great words and appreciate it. And I wish we had more time to get into depth. And hopefully we're going to have you back and we're going to talk about a lot of these things in depth. And thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Robin and Desiree. And I just wanted to say one more thing. Listen to Indigenous people.
Yeah, there you go.
Thank you.
I've been driving in my Indian car to the pound of the wheels drumming in my brain. My dash is dusty, my plates are expired. Please, Mr. Officer, let me explain. I got to make it to a powwow tonight. I'll be singing 49 down by the riverside, looking for sugar, riding in my Indian car. Got my T-bird in the glove box, I ain't got no spare. Got a feather from an eagle, I ain't got no care. The road is empty in my bottle of desire. Daylight is breaking, the sun touches fire. I got to make another powwow tonight. I'll be singing 49 down by the riverside, looking for sugar, riding in my Indian car.
That was a clip from a song entitled Riding in My Indian Car by Keith Sekola. Before that, Robin White was speaking with Julian Ankeny. I want to remind you that we are currently in the middle of our fall funding drive, and KBOO is an important resource for our community. City Councilor Joanne Hardesty, for example, who is leading the campaign for police accountability, is a longtime KBOO alumnus, having founded the talk show Voices from the Edge, which she hosted for years up until last March. On her show, She focused on city government and its stance on poverty, homelessness, gentrification, criminal justice, transportation, and a host of other issues that matter to you, our listeners. And now our very own Joanne serves as a city councilor herself and the leader of a progressive bloc on the council. Please, if you have the resources, support KBOO by going to kboo.fm/give or mailing a donation to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. Because of our hardworking staff and our many volunteers and supporters, KBOO is still on the air at a time when so many community radio stations have ceased to broadcast. Please help us ensure that the station stays on the air by going to kboo.fm/give and donating today. To close our show, Jan Hocken talks with Hung Nam about recent developments in the campaign to defund the Portland Police Bureau and the national campaign calling for a people's budget and alternatives to policing. Nam is a teacher with the Portland Public Schools and served on the Citizens Police Budget Advisory Committee.
Hung Nam, welcome again to the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you've served on the Portland Police Bureau's Budget Advisory Committee and have been very involved in community organizing around policing and specifically the police budget. Last July, the City Council passed a budget that took $15 million away from the police bureau in response to the Black Lives Matter movement and community organizing. What's happened since July with the Portland police budget? And then perhaps we can talk about what lies ahead too, because of course this is a process and not just a cathartic moment.
Yeah. So with the decisions that were made, actually, I think they were made in June because the new budget starts in July. We actually made, you know, it wasn't as much as many of us were demanding, but Portland actually made one of the biggest cuts to the police budget of any city in the country nationally. There are a few that have made significant cuts like us.
New York and Los Angeles have made significant cuts, right?
Well, you know, Los Angeles is actually quite misleading because in absolute numbers, it's significant, but as a percentage, it's actually much smaller than us. So they, I think, cut $150 million in their police budget, but their budget is so much bigger that from talking to one of the organizers of the People's Budget LA, what we found out was that actually that $150 million cut was only a cut to the increase in the police budget. And in terms of, you know, proportion of the police budget that it cut, it was actually very minimal. So as far as the movement for defunding police, we're really seeing In this year's protests since the George Floyd killing and the uprising that started after that, we're really seeing a new movement here that has popularized really an abolitionist approach rather than calling for reforms that was mostly what we've seen in previous years. And after seeing year after year with struggles for reforming the police not working, now the demand has been nationally all over in major cities to defund the police as a part of a larger campaign to abolish the police. And I think just to simply say abolish the police is a little bit misleading. I think a better way of thinking about it is a call for reimagining or rethinking public safety. And really, the idea here is that the solution is not just a negative thing in terms of taking away funds from the police. The solution is to actually reallocate our public funds to address the real deep social issues and needs that we've relied on policing to address or misaddress for way too long. And so to address that, and I think that's really important because ultimately, when we start thinking about it in that way, we will see that defunding the police or abolishing the police in itself, at least conceptualized very simplistically, is not the answer and really is insufficient for many reasons. One important one being that really the role that the police serve is what's really important. So it's not just the public police, but policing. And a lot of policing is actually done also by private police or private security, which actually can be even less accountable and even more damaging than the public police. So I think it's really important to think broadly about reimagining our societies and our budgets and going away from policing and really thinking about, you know, things like our housing crisis and think about really the ultimately inequality, which is what policing deals with in using force and violence to maintain unequal social orders.
And this seems to be a way of finding a strategy between, on the one hand, defund the police, and the other is defend the police. The police are bad or evil versus the police are overburdened, and how to understand the police not only as deeply tied to a history of racism and maintaining a social order, but that the police are being asked to respond to all kinds of social problems for Absolutely. Which they're not equipped. So this seems to have, it has more of a empathy for the police tone to it, to say we've set up the society, expanded police powers in ways that go far beyond the history of what policing has, you know, historically taken up. Although there is that history of how the police are involved in repressing dissent. But do you think there's a difference in these kind of rhetorical strategies as well as actual organizing strategies in bringing people on board who are more ambivalent about the police?
Yeah, and I think it seems to be in flux. And I think there's no one clear narrative or movement out there. I think there where we see a variety of different kinds of narratives and messages. But I think there definitely are some clear narratives out there about the fact that, you know, we need to look at the role that the police play in society. And we really need to, and I think especially with this pandemic and the economic recessions that we are experiencing and will be experiencing for quite a while, that as we face austerity, I mean, you know, even without the recession, I'm a public school teacher, and we've basically faced austerity for most of my, you know, 20-year career as a teacher. And I think we're more and more people are recognizing that we are spending, I mean, not only are we just traumatizing and oppressing people, but we're spending enormous amounts of money on incarceration, policing, and the whole criminal justice system that do very little to remedy the social problems that the police are being used to respond to. I know that here in Oregon, we've had reports about like the state hospitals that end up with unhoused people for completely minor offenses, you know, stealing Gatorade out of a convenience store, you know, something that costs $2, and them ending up in a state hospital that costs, you know, I forget, over $1,000 a day. And then they end up eventually out in the streets again, with none of their problems addressed. And in fact, with these, you know, these experiences going through either these institutions or incarceration, end up out in the community with even in even a more challenged circumstances as far as trying to you know, fit in with the our communities in terms of finding housing, employment, and community to, you know, to be a part of society. And I think, you know, I think of examples of people like Jeremy Christian. I mean, he served time before, and serving time did not address the kind of problems that he was dealing with. He had even more exposure to racist gangs, and he came back out and ended up murdering people. This is the kind of system that we have kept relying on to address everything from our housing crisis and ultimately our inequality crisis.
What do you see going forward around the both the organizing around this broader vision of a people's budget and a people's notion of public safety? And I know there was recently a listening session of some kind that the city council held in late September. What are there critical times in this process for activists to and to intervene?
Yeah, I think in a lot of cities right now, they're going through their budget adjustments. And Portland is going through normally this fall, what they call a bump budget monitoring process that usually is not a public process at all. Nobody besides bureaucrats and technocrats pay attention to it because it's just minor adjustments of the budget as the actual spending happens. And this time, though, it is much more of a public process, both because the protests, these historic protests have continued for over 4 months with the clear demand that we want defunding of the police. And also because of this pandemic and the recession that is it's causing. Now, what we just found out from these sessions recently, actually both the state and our city government is not having to make major adjustments right now because there's a lag factor. You know, the incomes that are being not made right now will be affecting revenue for next year's budget. So it will take a little bit of time for this to really hit us. So right now, from what we've heard from our city and actually even our state, they are not facing major shortfalls immediately, but they will be expecting these shortfalls to come in to affect us for next year's budget. So, but one thing with the police is that they've abused their overtime so much with over-policing with the riot cops, the crowd control policing, with the rapid response teams, that they are, the police are asking for more money to fill their hole of overusing their overtime budget. And I know from being on their budget advisory committee that they had already budgeted extra millions of dollars, expecting in this election year, lots of protests in November and after the inauguration in January, as we saw in 2016. But they already blew through millions of that budget.
So, Hyung, in closing, this is an ongoing process that listeners and activists in the community will be following. What's the best place to follow the politics of the police budget?
We have a working group out of what was originally called the Police Reform Network that formed with organizations like Unite Oregon, Portland Cop Watch, Portland Metro People's Coalition, Portland Forward, and many others. And now we have several work groups. We still have a work group on the police contract, but we have a new work group on the police budget and defunding the police. So either through Unite Oregon or Portland Metro People's Coalition, people can follow what's going on there and get connected with the organizing.
And there's websites and social media available for both of those organizations.
Yes.
Unite Oregon and the Portland Metro People's Coalition. And we'll continue to have you and other activists on the show as we continue to follow this really important and central issue in our vision that a better world is not only possible, but necessary.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Young Nam, for being with us today on the Olmo Variety Hour.
That concludes our show for today. I want to thank Moles Bill Resnick, Robin White, and Jan Hawken for their contributions, and a special thanks to our guests today, Yeva Nersisian, Julian Ankney, and Hyung Nam. I am Patricia Kohlberg for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Please join us again next Monday morning for views, reviews, and interviews from a feminist, socialist, anti-racist, and anti-colonialist perspective. We're going to leave you today with a song called Hallucination by A Tribe Called Red and featuring the late John Trudell and Northern Voice. Thanks for listening.
We are the tribe that they cannot see. We live on an industrial reservation. We are the Halusa Nation. We have been called the Indians. We have been called Native American. We have been called hostile. We have been called pagan. We have been called militant. We have been called many names. We are the Halusa Nation. We are the human beings. The callers of names cannot see us, but we can see them. We are the Halusa Nation. Our DNA is of earth and sky. Our DNA is of past and future. We are the Halusa Nation. We are the evolution, the continuation. The Halusa Nation. The Halusa Nation.